protecting your home and property from flooding this hurricane season. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, we speak with the director of FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program, what you need to know this storm season. Then later, a conversation with Frontline's Michael Kirk. It's a preview of his talk here at WJCT next week. Plus, how you can be part of She Is Fierce Women's Wednesdays in St. Augustine and our book club, too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, important information as we get into hurricane season. This year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, predicts as many as 8 hurricanes, including several major storms. And it only takes one hurricane, as we all know, to cause great destruction. As we saw during last year's season, record amounts of flooding caused devastating damage to homes and businesses here in our area. FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program are urging property owners and renters, too, to take steps now to protect your homes and your property before a major storm hits. For many Floridians, that includes buying or renewing your flood insurance policy. To learn more, we spoke with David Marstad, Chief Executive of the National Flood Insurance Program at FEMA. David Marstad, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Good morning.
It's so important to have someone with FEMA on the line to let all of our listeners know what they should be doing this hurricane season, particularly here in Florida. As you know, Jacksonville suffered historic, devastating flooding in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. You at FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program are really trying to get the word out about flood insurance. Can you tell us who should have flood insurance in the state of Florida, and how important is it to have a flood insurance policy?
Well, I can't think of too many places in Florida where somebody wouldn't be taking the right steps to have a flood insurance policy. It's vitally important when a flood occurs for people to have flood insurance to help them on their road to recovery.
And isn't it true that some of the claims that go through the flood insurance program are from homeowners who live in a low-risk zone? They don't think that they might ever be flooded, but they are anyway. It's the unpredictability of flooding, I guess, that I'm curious to ask you about.
Sure. I mean, historically, on an annual basis, 25% of our claims are from areas that are in the low to moderate risk area. But we see after many of the major events, it can be up to 80% of the homes damaged can be in the low to moderate risk area. So we want to make sure that people understand that where it can rain, it can flood. And it's important that you are financially prepared. And part of that is having emergency savings. So you have dollars to take care of yourself for those first 2 or 3 or 4 days. But also to check your insurance coverage and make sure you have the right type of insurance to protect you from a flooding event. There are many people believe that or want to think that their homeowner policy covers them for a flood event, and it generally does not. You need to have a separate flood insurance policy. And so have a discussion with your insurance agent or representative with your insurance company and make sure you have the right insurance protection when that flooding event comes around the corner.
In anticipation of speaking with you, I took the step of calling my homeowner's insurance representative, and I bought a flood insurance policy for our house for this hurricane season. It is good for a year. You have to take the extra step of ordering the policy. It really wasn't that expensive. So what else do people need to know to get this policy and make sure they're covered?
Well, first of all, thank you for helping to close the insurance gap. That's a priority of FEMA's to make sure we have more people covered, because insured survivors get on the road to recovery far better than their neighbors who don't have the flood insurance protection that they need. So, as you did, have a good discussion with your insurance agent. Make sure that you go through what deductible options are available, how much coverage you need, understand what's covered on the policy and what's not covered under the policy. And then also, importantly, as we get into more of the real heart of the hurricane season, need to understand that generally there's a 30-day waiting period before that policy goes into effect. And so that's why we're really encouraging people right now, if they do not have a flood insurance policy, to take that step, take the action to get that coverage so that when that event strikes, you can understand and know that your family is going to be well protected.
People don't often think about flood damage when they think about storms and hurricanes, but floods can do the worst damage. Just an inch of water in a home can cause more than $25,000 in damage, according to FEMA. And so here in Florida, as you pointed out, David, most of the state needs to have this kind of protection, as we've learned the hard way. Let me ask you, bigger picture, going beyond Florida, as we are anticipating more severe storms more often in this country, going along with the impacts of climate change, what types of stresses and challenges does that place on the National Flood Insurance Program?
Well, our biggest challenge is for people to understand that we need to, both individually and in our neighborhoods and in our communities, be more resilient. Part of that is developing a culture of preparedness, that we think about how we can be prepared ahead of events. So really, our number one challenge is we need more people taking action and having a flood insurance policy, so that they don't have to rely on other government assistance or charity assistance, or dip into their savings to take care of an expense that they weren't necessarily expecting. So our big challenge is getting people to take action and contact their agent, their insurance representative, and learn about flood insurance, learn about what their flood risk is, and then buy a policy.
Right. They're typically, a basic policy is what, several hundred dollars. And that can cover a homeowner in terms of hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage, right?
Yeah, so if you qualify for what we call our preferred risk policy, where you're in an area that's outside the high risk area and the low to moderate risk area, you can buy coverage up to $250,000 on the residential property. You can buy $100,000 for your personal belongings. If you are a small business owner, you can buy up to $500,000 on the property. So coverage is available, and it's just, again, I can't stress enough the importance for people to understand their flood risk and take action. We encourage people to go to floodsmart.gov, where they can learn a lot about flood risk and flood insurance options, or download our the free FEMA mobile app on Apple or Android devices, so that they can also receive emergency alert notices in both English or Spanish.
Right. And when they go to floodsmart.gov, David, you just type in your address and see if you're in a high or low risk flood zone, correct? And then you can buy the insurance accordingly.
Yes, you can get some general information on floodsmart.gov, and then that's a good first step to become familiar with what flood insurance is about and what flood risk is about. But then you have to contact your agent to make sure that you get that policy put in place before hurricane season arrives.
It's underway now, so the sooner the better. Because as you pointed out, it takes 30 days for a policy to go into effect. And so get that flood insurance, people. Even if you think you're not in a high-risk area, you have the peace of mind of being protected, because storms in Florida can be so unpredictable. David Marstad, Chief Executive of the National Flood Insurance Program at FEMA. Thanks so much for spreading the word with our listeners about this really important information. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Again, that website is floodsmart.gov.
Up next, we speak with Frontline's Michael Kirk. It's a preview of his appearance here at WJCT next week. We'll be right back. Well, acclaimed documentary filmmaker Michael Kirk has produced, directed, and written more than 100 hours of Frontline, the PBS flagship long-form documentary series. Kirk has produced decades of documentaries, too many to mention here, but a few notable recent ones include The Choice and League of Denial, the NFL's concussion crisis. Michael Kirk is the winner of every major award in broadcast journalism. And the national television programming he's produced for Frontline has changed the culture in significant ways. We're so pleased to announce that Michael Kirk will be speaking at WJCT Studios next week, where you can meet and connect with him in person. We have a preview right now as he joins us by phone. Michael Kirk, a pleasure. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
I've long been such a fan of Frontline and your work. It's such an important program, and it has made a huge impact in our culture, our political culture, and our culture more broadly. There are so many shows you've produced that have been so significant. As I mentioned, the documentary you did about the NFL's concussion crisis, League of Denial, is just one example we could point to out of so many that have made an incredible impact and brought about change. And so I guess the first question I have for you is, how do you hit upon the choices you, how do you pick your topics? Because you seem to have a knack for hitting on the flashpoint topics of division in this country that really get to the meat of who we are as Americans and where we don't agree.
It's some of it comes from long-earned or hard-earned experience of not getting it right sometimes. When you make that many films, not all of them hit the mark. But fortunately, the vast majority do. And why? I think, I grew up out in America, not in Boston or New York or Los Angeles. I grew up in Idaho. I connect to a different kind of America in lots of ways, or different parts of America. So I'm always thinking about what my brothers in Idaho need to know and want to see. So a lot of my films and film choices are made about the hard choices around topics that affect people like them. So that's a big motivator, is thinking about, so what about all this talk about the concussions in the NFL? This goes back to 2013. And we decided to get to the bottom of it just because I'm fortunate enough in life to be paid to follow my curiosity and my nose into various topics. So football was one of them. It was completely eye-opening to me, a huge football fan until those moments, meeting some of my heroes and seeing what was happening to them, especially in the heroes from the bygone days before they really knew what was happening.
and so unwillingly had these injuries inflicted on them. So that changed me. I cover a lot, every president since Jimmy Carter, really. And so I'm in and out of Washington and the White House, national security, presidential power politics. I think I'm in the midst of making my 10th film about the Trump administration. Lots of films about Obama.
Yeah.
So I'm inside a lot of different things in lots of different ways.
And let's talk about how prolific you are. In 2018 alone, you produced 4 hours of programming for Frontline, Trump's Showdown. That was a look at the president's fight against the Justice Department's investigation of his campaign, and Trump's Takeover, a look at the takeover of the GOP by President Trump. Now, as you said, you've covered several presidents. How have you approached covering this administration? How have you put together these pieces with an eye toward the particular issues surrounding the Trump White House?
I really have become, over my lifetime, a student of presidential behavior, how they use their power, what they think about, where they come from. And because every 4 years I get to make a film called The Choice, which is the sort of woven biographies of the two presidential candidates. Last time it was Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And what those films are is really a history of the person, a biography of who they are as told by their friends and close associates and people who've come in conflict with them. So I knew Donald Trump psychologically from people who knew him all of his life and people who thought about him and written about him. I had a pretty good sense of who he was, and I wasn't, and so after he won, I wasn't tremendously surprised, because I also know there's another America, not on the coasts. And in another way, I knew him in a way that made him real to me, not a cookie cutout, not a cliche, not an evil at his heart kind of person. He has plenty of downsides and some upsides, and lots of other things that were interesting to me about him. How would it change Washington, a place I'm very familiar with, in and out of there for the last 40 years? So it's been fascinating to do it, and I was determined from the very beginning to try to understand who people are that voted for him, and why did they vote for him, and what was he doing to respond to that base and the lightning bolt, because he didn't expect to win that night, despite what they say now. I was basically there right afterwards, and it was clear that everybody was walking around sort of shell-shocked in Trump Tower. So Trump, I've spent a lot of time, and I'm continuing to do it now on the immigration story, trying to understand what he's about, what he's trying to do, and who the people are who love and admire what he's doing, and why they feel that way. What was it that their government wasn't delivering for them?
And Frontline is unique on broadcast television in its format. And the impact that you've had, Frontline's been around for, gosh, over 25 years now.
36 years.
I undersold it. I stand corrected. And your work is so important because it's a unique spot on the television dial, I think, to truly understand these critical issues in depth. Over the years, as you've produced all this work, what kinds of impact do you think you're having in parts of the country, as you said, not on the coast, people that are watching Frontline and learning so much about these issues?
The series itself, I was there at the very moment that we created it as the senior producer. The aspirations for the series in the beginning were to take a slightly different angle into things. There were in those days documentary series on all the networks, and journalism was a kind of different business in those days. Over the years, hundreds of films have been made. The series has itself is itself a living repository of the history of America over the last 35, 36 years, and that was always our aspiration. But the number one aspiration of the series was always inform people who are trying to decide what to do about the important issues of the day, who to vote for, what policies to support, to get people, give people an understanding of what is happening in the country that they have to make decisions about. I'm trying to give them the credit of being smart and interested and willing to hear many sides of a story, and the best front lines. They don't always hit that mark, but the very best front lines, I think, find an issue. When we did gun control, for example, a few years ago, it was right after the Newtown shootings, and we followed the efforts to try to get a piece of legislation passed so that people would understand the complicated arguments that go into something, even in the aftermath of such a tremendous tragedy, and it's that kind of an issue that if you work for Frontline and you make films for Frontline, you try to think about what's a cutting edge issue that lots of people have very strong opinions about, and how can we knife in there and get something that feels new, that helps people understand an issue even as tried and true as Second Amendment gun rights.
That brings me to your latest project. It's called Supreme Revenge. You take a look inside the war of control over the Supreme Court. Tell me about that one.
Well, it's always been something I've wanted to do, but it's always been hard to figure out how do you do it. And when the Justice Kavanaugh hearings turned into such an incredible American, in some ways, nightmare. The allegations, the response to the allegations, the fights on television. It reminded me of a different time when it really sort of started, that the process of advice and consent by the Senate became very political and very politicized. And that was back when the Democrats took down a Republican, Democrats like Ted Kennedy took down, and Joe Biden took down Robert Bork, a very conservative, ultra-conservative judge and professor, when everybody thought Ronald Reagan had nominated, everybody on the conservative side thought Ronald Reagan had nominated an amazing judge. And we also decided to dive into the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill moment as another example of politics entering into the judicial process. We think of the Supreme Court as this private citadel or crucible, maybe, where judges go in and they are apolitical to make big and important decisions. And many, many people have said in our newly deeply divided America, even that process has been sullied by politics. So I wanted to get inside all of that and see if that turned out to be true, and try to tell the story in such a way that viewers like people in Jacksonville and other places who don't really know all the details, and kind of in a way don't need to know the details, but they need to have a historical context to what was going on with the Kavanaugh hearings. And of course, my job is to provide historical and political context to that, hence Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, and the Robert Bork hearings.
And what do you think of the rumblings among some Democrats that the Supreme Court no longer needs to be a lifetime appointment, or maybe there needs to be more than 9 Supreme Court justices? These aren't the first time in American history these ideas have been floated.
It's an interesting problem that's happening now. If you accept the theory, which I think we try to demonstrate, which is that the process is much more politicized than it's ever been. It's been growing since the 1980s, but now here we are at a critical moment where, if a Republican president, Donald Trump, let's say the Democrats win the Senate in 2020, but Trump is reelected. Trump is very unlikely, given the current environment, to be able to name a new justice or any new justices against a Democratic United States Senate. Very, very hard to do. So what happens when justices die? Their positions may not be filled. You might have the court shrinking to 7 or 6 votes because the Senate and the president may not be able to agree on who somebody is that would want to fill that seat, especially, as I say, in this divided and politically charged environment. So Very interesting times, and it's not surprising to me, of course, that Democrats, now that we have a largely conservative, we have a conservative majority on the United States Supreme Court, thanks to the lifetime work of Mitch McConnell and others, you now have a very strongly conservative Republican Supreme Court, and it doesn't surprise me that Democrats would want to try to enact legislation that would broaden the base. Others are talking about a 20-year term, so you'd have term limits on Supreme Court justices. All of these things, of course, are open to real political battles. And I hope when a viewer watches Supreme Revenge, they feel prepared to enter into that discussion.
And when does Supreme Revenge appear on PBS Frontline?
Well, it has already aired.
It's already aired.
But you can always watch it the PBS, just go Frontline PBS, and all the films are aired or put on the web, and you can watch it uninterrupted.
And you've done so many. What's next in your sights? What else are you working on?
I'm making 5 hours during the rest of this year, which is a pretty substantial bite I'm trying to take out of understanding things. But I'm racing to get a couple of more things told before the 2020 election. One of them is a film in the fall called Power, Politics, and the Border, which is about the Trump administration and immigration. And then 4 hours that will air in January of 2020, right before the primaries begin, called The Divided States of America. Two nights, 2 hours a night, a discussion of what started in 2008 with Barack Obama and where we are now.
Well, this is all just a prelude to your appearance here next Tuesday night when you come to WJCT Studios to talk about your work with Frontline. It's an evening with Frontline's Michael Kirk. Our own CEO, David McGowan, will join you on stage for a conversation about your career and all of these issues. We encourage everyone to register now to come see you. We're excited to host you. So, Michael Kirk, thanks so much for your time, and we look forward to seeing you here next week.
I'm really looking forward to meeting people from Jacksonville and hearing questions and having conversations back and forth. It's the way I keep myself grounded.
It's Michael Kirk next Tuesday at WJCT. Go to our website for tickets and information. Thanks so much, Michael.
You bet.
And we'll be right back.
If you don't know his name, you know his work. Join WJCT on June 18th for an evening with Frontline's Michael Kirk, an award-winning documentarian. For tickets and more info, visit wjct.org/events.
Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit wjct.org/events to explore what's coming your way.
WJCT's new podcast tells the stories of local people.
You have one of your soldiers laying there, and you have the person that is trying to kill your soldiers on the opposite side.
It wasn't so much that I felt guilty. I felt like it was impossible for him to love me.
I wasn't born with a crack pipe in my mouth. Thank you, Jesus. I'm not going to die with one.
What It's Like is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. Good morning, Michelle. Hey, Turntable Tuesday's on tonight. We're going to play all of the music from Breaking Bad, double album, four sides. It's awesome. I didn't bring any with me, but do tune in at 9 o'clock for Electro Lounge. Turntable Tuesday, the music from Breaking Bad.
This book club segment is underwritten by San Marco Books and More.
Welcome back. It's a celebrated story looking at a complex depiction of race, gender, and sexuality. Passing by Nella Larson is this month's pick on the First Coast Connect Book Club. Stacey Goldring is here now with more and some other interesting summer read ideas she's picked up. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being with us. And I'm excited that you chose this book this month, Passing. People might not realize what that word even means, but 100 years ago or so in this country, if you were of mixed racial heritage, you often tried to pass as white.
Correct.
And so that's what passing means.
Correct.
Yeah.
And this will be our summer read for all of our book clubs. So I'm really excited for people to go pick it up. Shop local and go to your local bookstore and pick it up or reserve it now at the library. I don't care how you read it, listen to it, whatever, but this book will be incredibly important and I believe the discussions in the fall will be incredibly rich. Why? Passing it's a novella. It's super duper short. However, it is incredibly powerful and it talks about identity. And a lot of my work has to do with searching for your own identity. And in this case, we are in the hands of an amazing Harlem Renaissance writer, Nella Larson. And it is a book that explores the choices that two women make in regards to how they're going to be identified as Americans. And, you know, everything going on right now with gender and who we are as Americans and, the ethos and pathos of our country can be summed up in this novella. So I am super excited to talk about it this fall.
And so this book tells the story of a mixed race woman who lives in Harlem in the 1920s named Irene.
Correct.
And what happens to her?
I can't tell you. You have to read the book. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be a killjoy, but because it's a novella and it's so thin, it's about Irene and her friend and the choices they make. And, you know, I'm a big fan of ambiguity. So if you don't like ambiguity, then you really need to read this book and get over that.
This is important, too, in terms of studying our racial history. This is a fictional story, but it could have been a real story about any number of people in America back then who resented segregation and knew it was wrong, and they had the ability to evade Jim Crow by pretending or passing as white Americans.
Exactly.
And going into places and situations where they weren't supposed to go.
And we explored this a few years ago when we read Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man by James Weldon Johnson. Remember that? So we're revisiting it again, but we're revisiting it through a female lens. And I think that we're going to get a very different, it'll be a very different feeling because you also have to layer in the fact that these are women who are having to make these choices, which is very different from the James Weldon Johnson book. So I'm really, really excited to talk about it this fall. And I'm really excited today to talk about living authors. And you know, that doesn't happen to me very often because I like my authors very dead. However, just back from
the dead
New York
authors, all the best dead authors, you know them all. But you just came back from the Book Expo in New York.
Yes, yes. And I probably carried home more than 500 pounds of books by the time it was all said and done. However, I could fit in my bag today books that I feel are really winners. And I only bring quality to our listeners. So I want to talk about a few titles today. And you're going to have to get that cane out that they used to do in the old vaudevillian shows to get me off air.
Give you the gong on the gong show.
Yeah, because I am so excited to talk about these titles. And I've given them all great categories. So my first category is Bellboy, Get My Bags. And the winner of that category is The Plaza by New York Times journalist Julie Satow. This book It looks so good. And there was a great article in the New York Times just yesterday, the day before, about the plaza. So I think you should go read the story and then you should go ahead and gobble up this book. Just a little bit about it. And remember, just shut me up, sister. That's fine by me. From the moment in 1907 when New York millionaire Alfred Vanderbilt strode through the Plaza Hotel's revolving doors to become the first guest, to the afternoon in 2007 when a mysterious Russian oligarch paid a record price for the hotel's largest penthouse, this 18-story white marble edifice at the corner of 5th and 59th Street has radiated wealth and luxury. So
this is the story of the plaza.
It is, but it's written with a journalist's touch. So we know it's real, it's been sourced, it's been fact-checked. So we get that feeling of F. Scott Fitzgerald. We get to experience Eloise pouring water down the mail chute. And then we get to learn about the deep, dark secrets. There was a murder at this hotel.
Wow.
Yeah.
And isn't it true? I've heard this a lot. My daughters loved Eloise, like so many little girls. Isn't it true that Eloise was based on Liza Minnelli? That when she stayed at the hotel with her mother, Judy Garland, she would just run around the hotel at will and get into all kinds of mischief when she was a kid. I've heard that.
I'm going to let you go ahead and experience the book, and then you will find out what's fact and fiction.
Ah.
However, we can combine Eloise with lions in the bathtub and falcons flying all over the place. And dowagers, these widowed dowagers during the 1920s, are the reason why that the plaza could survive the Depression, because they basically financed it by living there.
They treated it like a hotel. They lived there.
And now really
it's, or like an apartment, rather.
And now really it is. There's a lot of condos there, and we're not quite sure who's owning what. So the beauty of this book is that Seta, being a journalist, she shows us what's going on behind the scenes financially with this hotel, starting with how President Donald Trump being the only owner to bankrupt the hotel, to an Indian tycoon who bought the hotel sight unseen and managed it from his jail cell in Delhi.
Get out of here. Okay, so it's The Plaza by Julie Satel.
Correct.
What else do you have on that pile of books?
Oh, my goodness. Well, how many hours does everyone have?
We've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, well, All Things Considered is going to have to wait, because I want to talk about The Strangers We Kept. And this particular title, I'm holding this up so all the listeners can see it. Well, you get to
see
it.
I can see it.
This is from the category, Let's Judge a Book by Its Cover. I grabbed this book because I thought, this is an amazing cover. And lo and behold, the artist got it right. Listen to this story, okay? This is the tale of secretaries turned spies, of love and duty and sacrifice, inspired by the true story of the CIA plot to infiltrate the hearts and minds of Soviet Russia, not with propaganda, but with Dr. Zhivago. So this is the story of these two women, one who is a spy and one who's a bumbling novice spy, who have to smuggle this book out of Russia in order for it to be published outside of the country, in order for it to grab the hearts and minds of the Russians and like win the Cold War.
Interesting. I love intrigue stories. So that one is
The Secrets We Kept.
The Secrets We Kept.
Correct. Right. And now—
okay.
Now we're going to go over to, I know time's wasting. Okay, I'm going to go right to Malcolm Gladwell, because here's a nonfiction, and I love Malcolm Gladwell because he makes us look at things in a very different way. And this book really speaks to a lot of the work I do in the community. It's called Talking to Strangers. And he asked this question, how did Fidel Castro fool the CIA? Why did Neville Chamberlain think he could trust Adolf Hitler? Why are campus sexual assaults on the rise? Talking to Strangers is classic Gladwell. He challenges controversial events and how we look at them. So he takes a look at Bernie Madoff, Amanda Knox, the suicide of Sylvia Plath, Jerry Sandusky, the death of Sandra Bland, and he throws out all our understanding of these stories. He argues that something is very wrong. And what is that? It's the tools and strategies we use to make sense of other people we don't know. It doesn't work. We have to learn how to talk to strangers so they are no longer the other, capital O.
Malcolm Gladwell is such an interesting author. He always has this unique, quirky, fascinating take on things. And another book he wrote,
T. Tipping Point.
Called Tipping Point, I think, mm-hmm. is one that people have heard of. Mm-hmm. He's written several great books, but I'm not surprised you choose him for your list this summer. So it's Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers. Mm-hmm. And last but not least.
Oh, I have to pick one more? Okay.
The Dutch Girl.
Oh, okay. Okay. We'll
go with that. Audrey Hepburn okay. and World War
See,
II.
See, everyone needs a good friend just to put them in the right direction. Okay. So this is by Robert Matson. And this, okay, you know I have a rule. No titles with the word girl in it. I am tired of every publisher pushing title with the word girl in it. So that's this category.
Why is that bad?
Because enough already. Get creative. Because of remember Gone Girl? Once that book hit the bestseller list, everyone said, okay, everyone, we're Orphan Girl, this girl, Girls Club. I'm so nauseating. So I pick a book called—
You picked one.
Dutch Girl.
Dutch Girl.
You know, I'm a hypocrite. All right. So Dutch Girl, when we think of Audrey Hepburn, this is a book about Audrey. We think Breakfast at Tiffany's, but let's go in a whole different direction. This is a biography of when she was a young child, and it reveals her intense experiences through 5 years of Nazi occupation in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, I wrote a book about a Holocaust survivor who hid in the Dutch countryside, so this really spoke to me. According to Hepburn's son, quote, "The war made my mother who she was. Her experience in the war included participating in the Dutch resistance, working as a doctor's assistant during the Battle of Arnhem, the brutal execution of her uncle, and surviving the hunger winter. And she also had to contend with the fact that her father was a Nazi agent and her mother was a Nazi sympathizer for the first 2 years of the war."
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So this book reveals all that. There are new photographs that are in this book from her personal collection. This author, also a journalist, has been able to study up to this point, classified documents from the Dutch archives that he reveals in the book. So again, this is the journalist in me coming out. This is a great book about a famous star who we all love, but this is a little known side of her.
Sure. People don't realize that she nearly starved to death as a child during
right.
the war, like so many children in Europe at that time.
Yeah, that the winter of 44 was devastating.
Yeah. These are all amazing picks. And as we're listening to Stacy lead our book club, which she's been doing on the show now for over 6 years, we want to take a moment and let everyone know if you have a question about a title or you have a suggestion, it's easy to get in touch with Stacy. You just email her at bookclub@wjct.org. And so you lead book groups all over town, including mm-hmm. At San Marco Books and More.
Correct.
When are you going to be appearing at San Marco Books and More next?
Okay, so there's next and then there's next. So uh-huh. the book clubs start up again in September, and believe it or not, do not fall off your chair, Melissa, but I am working on starting a Facebook page for the book clubs. Yes, welcome to the 20th century. Yeah, anyway, so more on that later. So I'll have all the dates listed on there. We're firming them up for the season. But also in September, I'm sure you've heard that we have a comrade who is coming to Jacksonville, a little known author. I say that tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
Amor Towles is coming to the bookstore in September. So I will keep you posted on when he'll be there. But you'll see us all there ready to toast to the count at the Hotel Metropole, a.k.a. the San Marco Bookstore.
Always good to have you, and thanks so much for all the great summer reading ideas.
Thank you.
And we will be right back. Stay with us.
Science and technology programs in American universities just aren't graduating enough people to fill all the jobs. Might one solution be H-1B visas?
Every time a company uses an H-1B visa to hire a foreign national, a good chunk of money goes to fund training and scholarships for Americans.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Using H-1Bs to fund STEM. We'll go beyond the acronyms next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Robin Young. Coal exports have rebounded under President Trump, and some coal miners in western Kentucky say that's been a lifeline for an industry in decline.
I believe that we have a coal industry still existing, albeit a glimmer of what it once was, because of President Trump.
But what about health and environmental risks? That's next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, inside Kim Jong-un's North Korea, we speak with journalist Anna Fifield, who's visited the country 12 times and interviewed members of the leader's family. We'll talk about daily life and economic change, the regime's brutal repression, the failed nuclear talks with the U.S., and some strange moments when Dennis Rodman visited the country. Fifield's new book is The Great Successor. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
How should America deal with those who threaten us?
Being the best, which we are, isn't a birthright.
Former Defense Secretary Ash Carter worked for more than 35 years inside government under presidents of both parties. He's offering a new look at one of the world's largest and most complex organizations, the Pentagon. Ash Carter, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
There's a train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on board.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it is your chance to see an internationally renowned speaker whose story is so inspiring. Hollywood is making a movie about her life. Yeah, best-selling author Kara Brookins left a bad relationship, and then together with her four kids, with their bare hands, they built their own dream house, a 3,500 square foot home, all by themselves. And they used only YouTube videos for guidance. Kara documented this experience in her best-selling book, Rise, How a House Built a Family. You can see Kara Brookins speak and do a whole lot more next week in St. Augustine at She is Fierce Women's Wednesdays at the Treasury. Founder and CEO Kelly Youngs is here now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. And this is going to be a great evening because you always have amazing speakers at She is Fierce events. Tell me about Kara Brookins.
Okay, so Kara Brookins is a personal inspiration for me. She is, as you said, she's a name that not everybody knows, but most women I've spoken to know her story. She had billions and billions of views online of her story because really she left an abusive relationship, a terrible situation with four kids, and made a decision that she was going to transform her life. And together with these four children, built this phenomenal 3,500 square foot brick home and really changed everything about what their life was at that time.
What made her decide to do that?
I think it was necessity. So she was in a situation where she had to create something new for her children and then had this vision that she wanted to build a house and move out into the woods in Arkansas, like something you'd never imagine. And then really just didn't have enough money to hire a contractor and said, you know what, we're going to do it anyway.
So she and her kids, who were aged 17, 15, 11, and 2, they poured the concrete, they laid the bricks, they ran the gas lines, they did everything themselves.
Everything, yes. And really, I think what I'm most excited about at this Women's Wednesdays event is that she is just a powerhouse. She is a woman who made a choice, followed through, and has turned that really into global success. As you said, there's a movie that is being made about her life with some Hollywood celebrities that I'm not allowed to name.
We can't say who's
right
going
now.
To play her in
no,
the movie.
No, I can't. I want to, but I cannot. And she, but she's going to be a household name next year. So this is a fantastic opportunity to come and meet and learn from this incredible woman.
And not only will people get to see Kara Brookins speak, you have a lot of other goodies planned.
Yes. Well, as you know, we normally do a series in the summer. And this year we are doing one massive event for Women's Wednesday in St. Augustine. I want to thank Bozard Ford Lincoln and Flagler Health Plus, who are our incredible St. Augustine partners who help us bring this thing to life. We are doing really like for women who've been to Women's Wednesdays before, it's the next level. So we're going to have headshots. We're going to have a stylist area where you can get a mini makeover. We're going to have all kinds of interactive games. Flagler Health Plus is actually leading a wellness area where you can get wellness assessments. We'll have local fitness partners doing a ton of cool stuff. Instagrammable photo stations, a create space with DIY projects. It's like no event you've seen in North Florida before.
This is coming up next Wednesday night at the Treasury, which, by the way, if you've never been to the Treasury in St. Augustine, it's worth going just to check out that beautiful Art Deco space.
It is so glam and so fabulous and just the perfect venue for what we're putting on.
Okay. So, by the way, this is the only Women's Wednesday you're doing this summer.
This is it for St. Augustine. This is it. And I hope that everybody, I know people are used to us doing a series, so I want to make sure that everybody knows that this is, we're taking all the energy of that series and putting it into one phenomenal night.
It's going to be a great event. So get your tickets now at Eventbrite or sheisfiercehq.com. Full disclosure, I'm pleased to lead the Jacksonville chapter events. We have one coming up later this summer in Jacksonville, but we'll save that for another conversation. This is your chance to see best-selling author and public speaker Kara Brookins. She's the author of the best-selling book Rise, How a House Built a Family. You'll see her story on the big screen next year. Mark your calendar now for Women's Wednesdays. This is Wednesday, June 19th in St. Augustine. Get those tickets now. Kelly Youngs, always so good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's going to be a great evening. Again, tickets for that at Eventbrite or at sheisfiercehq.com. And that is our show today. Thanks so much for being with us. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Our director is Michelle Corum. And on tomorrow's show, we mark the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub tragedy in Orlando in conjunction with World Blood Donation Day. That is coming up tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you Wednesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.